From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Storm Roberts started producing and distributing world music records years before anyone was even calling it world music. On today's Fresh Air, Roberts plays some of his seminal recordings. Also, journalist A.C. Green tells us about living with another person's heart. 2 years ago, at the age of 64, he received a heart transplant. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the Jack Kerouac Collection, a new reissue of the poet and novelist reading with jazz accompaniment. And we have a reading from poet Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington today threw out one of Oliver North's three convictions and ordered the trial judge in the North case to hold further hearings on two other convictions. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The court reversed North's conviction for destroying and altering documents because the court said the trial judge had improperly instructed the jury on two other counts, accepting an illegal gratuity and aiding and abetting obstruction of Congress. The court ordered a further hearing by the trial judge to determine whether North's right not to incriminate himself had been violated. Specifically, the court ordered Judge Gerhard Gesell to review all the testimony and the witnesses in the case to determine whether North's compelled testimony before Congress was used in any way to obtain evidence against him. Gesell concluded at the time of the North trial that the prosecution's evidence was free from any such taint, but the Court of Appeals has now required a probing hearing in which witnesses will be called and testimony reviewed line by line, item by item. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh, who supervised the Iran-Contra investigation, said he was considering what his next step will be. At a news conference this afternoon, North said he hoped Walsh would end what he called a long and bitter ordeal for his family. The House Ethics Committee recommended today that Representative Barney Frank be reprimanded by the full House for violations stemming from his relationship with a male prostitute. Committee Chairman Julian Dixon said the committee voted unanimously to recommend the disciplinary action. The Massachusetts Democrat is accused of fixing parking tickets for male prostitute Stephen Gobey and of overseeing a misleading recommendation on Gobey's behalf. Thousands of Ethiopian Jews waiting in Addis Ababa to go to Israel will be allowed to leave within a few days. There have been reports that Ethiopia was demanding Israeli arms in exchange for allowing the Jews to emigrate. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
When Israel and Ethiopia renewed diplomatic relations last November, Ethiopia agreed to allow Jews remaining in the country to immigrate to Israel to join their families. But a few weeks ago, the government of embattled Ethiopian President Mengistu Haile Mariam stopped issuing passports. Thousands of Jews from the province held by Tigrayan rebels fighting Mengistu have been streaming into the capital, Addis Ababa, where they have set up makeshift camps around the Israeli embassy. Israel has vigorously denied a spate of rumors about the suspension, some of which said Mengistu was holding the Jews as hostage in exchange for Israeli arms, including cluster bombs. There are no arms for Jews deals, say Israeli officials, nor is Israel giving military aid to Mengistu. The delays, they say, are purely technical, and the exodus will resume in a short time. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 33 points to close at 2,961. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pop and dance music from around the world have started to catch on in America. Now we call it world music. But it wasn't too long ago that the only people interested in music from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and India were ethnomusicologists. My guest, John Storm Roberts, was one of the exceptions. He's been listening to music of other cultures most of his life, and he's been bringing music from around the world to Americans since the early 70s. That's Ghana High Life music from Robert's 1973 record, Africa Dances, one of the seminal records of what's come to be called Afropop. Several of Robert's early records have recently been reissued on CD by his company Original Music. Original Music is both a record label and a distribution company with a varied catalog of world music records, videos, and books. Roberts is also the author of the books Black Music of Two Worlds and The Latin Tinge. No one was using the expression world music when Roberts started listening as a teenager in England. He told me it was his parents who first got him listening.
There was a flamenco fad in England in the 30s. Calypso they knew from the 30s. Jazz and blues for rather personal reasons. My father, even at Cambridge in the 20s, had a friend who imported American blues records. So there were people who were interested. It's just nobody had thought of a label to stick on it. When I started, there wasn't any such animal. I mean, as a kid, we were buying anything we could find, and if it had an alphabet we couldn't even identify, we bought the record instantly. But, you know, it was Arabic music or this or that or the other. There wasn't a label to cover the whole thing.
It seems to me the attitude about certain international music has changed completely. It used to be people wanted to protect the purity of music. They were unhappy when there were Western influences on African music. And now there's a celebration of this cross-fertilization. What do you think of the change in attitude?
It's more realistic. I mean, basically, it wasn't that people objected to influences on African music. They objected to any influence that had happened in the last 50 years, or more precisely, any influence that had happened since they started looking.
Right.
You know, it's like everybody over a certain age hates the music that displaced the music that they loved when they were young. I mean, it's nonsense. One of the most major influences on African music is the Islamic influence over 1,000 years and still creeping across Africa. And do you hear people denouncing the rotten Islamification of African music? No. You know, it's also, you have to remember that things start in a rather weird way. I mean, very early Congolese recordings were actually very bad attempts to imitate Cuban music. And these attempts to imitate Cuban music led to a splendid, major, very influential new style. If they'd all been able to play Cuban music, of course, it might never have happened. So in other words, the process, a very good process, can come out of things that look as if they're not a good thing at the beginning.
Since you mentioned the influence of Cuban music on African music, why don't we hear something that I think is a good example of that? And this is from the first album that you produced. The album is called Africa Dances. And this is a piece that was recorded in Zaire. You describe it as African jazz. Do you want to say anything about it? I think it certainly shows the influence of Cuban music.
Yeah, it's probably what people who are involved in African music now will know as soukous, except that soukous was a rhythm that came along later. It's kind of pre-soukous Congolese music. It was, I may say, this cut enormously influential. I mean, I remember a nightclub in Nairobi, when this would start up, the band, resident band, would start playing this at 4 a.m, and everybody would start chanting, and you felt that the whole place was going to kind of lift up into the dawn like some kind of spaceship.
What year was this recorded in?
I'm not sure. I heard it. It was a big hit in 1963, so I would say 62, 63.
Okay, here we go. So some music from the album Africa Dances, which is some early examples of world music, an album produced by my guest John Storm Roberts. Can you explain why there was such a strong Cuban influence on certain parts of African music?
Fundamentally, no. But practically speaking, yes. The way it worked was that sometime in the 30s, CBS masters of Cuban groups of the septeto style, the groups that had basically guitars and maybe one trumpet playing in a very kind of wrought iron sort of way, were brought into England, and the masters were sent over and they were pressed and they were sold throughout Africa. It was an enormous influence. I mean, Francis Bebe, who is a major musicologist and musician from Cameroon, and a friend of mine, was telling me about the famous GV series, which was the prefix of these records. And then Okot Bitek, who is a Ugandan playwright I met once, was going on about them too. So in other words, they were sold right across the continent. Why it was so powerful, I think, is because Cuban music has very strong African influences. But at the same time, you have to remember, any particular African music is, or anyway used to be, pretty local, whereas the Cuban stuff was kind of generalized so that it sounded familiar to people in both East Africa and West Africa, and at the same time didn't sound like somebody else's music. I mean, it was a kind of a generalized African sound.
Let's talk about when you lived in Kenya. I'm sure that was a kind of critical experience for you and your interest in world music.
Yeah, what it was when I started giving back what I was learning. I mean, I really started getting involved in listening to music from all over the world in my teens in London. I mean, I bought an Umm Kulthum record, and it took me 2 years to discover that she was the greatest of Egyptian singers of the 20th century. You know, that kind of thing. We were really buying everything. But it was in Kenya that I started writing about it.
You went to Kenya to write for the East African Standard.
I went to Kenya as what's known in England as a sub-editor. I'm the person who puts the headlines on the reporter's stuff and, depending on whom you believe, make it literate or ruin it. You know?
Right.
And I went there just 3 weeks before independence, and discovered there was all this music being played on the Swahili language service of the radio that nobody could tell me about, including my African friends, who were all kind of upwardly mobile and, you know, the new professional class and things. And this was Swahili language guitar music, and they didn't want to know about it. They were more interested in the Congolese stuff. And so I started finding out and began by writing an article, front page feature section of the East African Standards, photographs taken by me, translations, transliterations, interviews, you name it. I think, and I was paid $12.50 for that. So that was the beginning of my career as a professional writer about African music.
What were the American and European hits that were being played in Africa during the years that you lived there?
I don't remember, because I didn't listen to them. I mean, we're talking 63, 64, so obviously the Beatles were big, the Rolling Stones, people like that. I tell you, somebody who was enormously popular in Kenya, of course, was Jim Reeves. I say of course, sorry. Somebody who was enormously popular in Kenya was Jim Reeves, the country singer. I mean, I once read one of those weird trivia statistics whereby outside the U.S., Norway had the biggest sales of Jim Reeves in a particular year, and Kenya had the second biggest.
I guess what I find interesting about the influence of country music in Africa is that in America, a lot of country music was considered fairly anti-black in a way, you know, very, just very separatist music. And you don't think of it as having a strong influence on African-American music.
It does, though. I mean, there's quite a black audience for country music, and always was. I mean, the fact that many of the people playing it had undesirable attitudes was a different matter. I mean, one of the best kept secrets, I've only seen it in one book, was that Elvis Presley's first really enthusiastic public was black teenagers on Beale Street. Now, the whites don't want to admit to that. On his anniversary, nobody brought that up, but it was true. And in Africa, I think the thing is country music's relatively simple. We're talking about certain sorts of country music. An enormously popular artist was Jimmy Rogers of the 1930s. Jimmy Rogers was also the man who made what was then hillbilly music into a style that was nationally popular in the States, because it was clean, it was simple, it was easily graspable, and it was attractive. And that you could say the same things about Jim Reeves. I mean, the real nasal kind of back-in-the-hollers kind of field recordings wouldn't go anywhere in Africa.
Well, you actually have a record that shows a really strong Jimmy Rogers influence. Well, this is particularly true in the guitar playing on the record. This is from another album that you produced called African Acoustic Music from the Copper Belt. And you want to listen to that? Is there anything you could tell us about this performance?
Only that the Jimmy Rogers runs in the guitar are by no means unique. I've got a tape of a South African 78 with the same things. I've heard Congolese musicians who do a wonderful mix of runs. You know, you'll get one real Cuban run next to a Jimmy Rogers run. The country music, the influence of American U.S. country music in Africa was ongoing and enormous from the 30s throughout, and nobody's really noticed it because all the references are kind of scattered, you know, passing comments by people. It's the sort of thing that ethnomusicologists didn't approve of, and so they didn't take much notice of it.
Right. This is also from the 1960s, yes?
This was recorded in 1950, I think, 7, by Hugh Tracy, who founded the International Library of African Music. It was recorded in the mine compounds of Zambia and was really an area which was very closely linked with Zaire, with the pre-Sukus music. I mean, the mines in Zambia, just across the border from the mines in what was Katanga and is now Shaba. So it's really all one style.
Let's give it a listen. Abana ni wafyala, abana wasuma, na fyale tiwele wele tabana. Abana ni wafyala, abana wasuma, na fyale tiwele wele tabana. Na fyale tiwele wele, na fyale tiwele wele, na fyale tiwele wele. The performers are Kabushi and Mwenya. Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is John Storm Roberts. He's the founder of Original Music, which is a company that's been producing and distributing world music since around 1982. He's also the author of the books Black Music of Two Worlds and The Latin Tinge. This is Fresh Air. John Storm Roberts is my guest. You were telling us that you got to Kenya about 3 weeks before it got its independence. It really makes me think about how much all the cross-influence had to do with colonization, don't you think?
Some of it, yeah. I mean, really, the reality is that this whole concept, as far as I'm concerned, of national musics in pure form is just a fantasy. I mean, there may be three characters sitting in the middle of the bleakest desert in Australasia performing something that had no influence from anywhere else. But I don't believe it. Australian Aboriginal music was influenced from Polynesia. Africa was always permeable borders. I mean, the fact that 19th century Europeans showed up and didn't notice anything much and thought that it was, you know, this kind of, in this primitive, pristine state was just plain old Victorian ignorance. And everything is the result of something else and the result of blendings of other things, some of them local, some of them not. And that's true anywhere you go. So, yes, colonization, They were colonies. Music happened in those colonies. I think it may be interesting that actually a lot of this music developed towards the end of the colonial period and the beginning of the independence period, but I wouldn't even make too much of that because I think there's all sorts of things to do with communications. Just a lot of different elements. Certainly, I think that the end of the colonial period began a period where you didn't need to play waltzes to please the paying customers. But, I mean, there are a lot of things one can postulate in terms of musical politics, but, you know, basically they're all just interpretations. But essentially all music comes from other music, some of it local, and usually with a catalyst from somewhere else. And all music is going somewhere else.
Do you think that there's an element of fad and commercialization that's going along with the new popularity of world music?
Oh, undoubtedly, sure. And I mean, there are slogans that I don't intend to get into, which are just regarded as jokes that some companies use that they appear to be serious about. But the thing is, there's always fad and fancy, and there's always this thing of novelty hits. One of the favorite things of the record industry is falling into the novelty hit catch again, where something hits because it's a novelty, so they try and do it again and lose a lot of money. But the real thing goes on, and serious stuff goes on. I'm a great believer in Pareto's law, you know, basically the theory that 80% of anything is eh, and 20% of it is more than eh. And that applies to any sort of music, and that applies to anything that's going on now, including the crossover stuff. I think the difference is you get a lot of... There's a guy called Ismail Lo, who's a Senegalese, and the Senegalese, real interesting stuff. They're full of funk, they're full of electronics, they're full of, hey, hey, what's happening, man, you know? And some of them, like the... Some of the recordings, like some of the later Youssou N'Dour recordings, are dismal if you know the originals that he was doing for the Senegalese. They're not dismal if you don't, because they're a change, at least. But if you know the real thing, they're dismal. Because some French producer or somebody decided they could make him into an international star, God save the mark, which they won't, any more than they did with Sunny Ade or anybody else. You know, they're just wasting everybody's time, not that it matters. But then you get people like Ismail Lo, who has everything in there except the kitchen sink because he likes it. And the end result is different.
Is there a lot of competition now between American companies and African companies for who's going to sign and distribute the more popular Afropop performers?
Absolutely doesn't work like that. Firstly, America is a very bad market for Afropop. America is not interested in large terms. I mean, England, though a much smaller country, is much more interested. The last CD we put out, our major American producer ordered 1/5 the quantity that the Japanese ordered from us. I've been a journalist for 35 years, or I was a journalist for 35 years. Journalists, particularly those who are enthusiastic about things, need new things to write about. They're interested in what's new. These kind of music tend to get written about. And it's not invalid. It's just that basically what sells records is not a small group of real enthusiasts. I mean, how many can they buy each? What's important is millions of people who may not be that interested but are just interested enough to go in and lay down $10. I mean, commercially, that's what's important. But what happens as far as the American companies are concerned is that we license stuff. We license it either from Europe or Africa. So basically the record's first put out in Europe or first put out in Africa, and then it's licensed for production and distribution here. There are exceptions, but there is not competition. Paris and, to a lesser extent, London are the non-African centers.
How did you get into the business of world music?
Basically, I had Africa dancers sitting around in the cellar, and we were thinking of moving, and we put together a one-page flyer to try and get rid of what we had left. I mean, I put that record out, and I hadn't the faintest idea what I was doing. I mean, I think we sold 200 copies in the first 5 years. This was before I started original music. And it occurred to me, obviously, the way to make this stuff available, if I want to sound less commercial about it, is mail order. I mean, we're talking, when I put out Africa Dances, the idea was that virtually nobody knew that African music existed other than Ola Tunji and, you know, the occasional drum. And the idea of Africa Dance is to show the enormous variety of music there was. And I still like people music. I mean, the common thread, apart from the fact that we never put out anything that's going to be expensive because we don't have any money, so you can't expect any big stars on original music, is that I'm involved in what I call street music, which is the music that falls between what the ethnomusicologists are interested in and what the local commercial record companies regard as hip, which is basically three-quarters of the world's music. So that's what we do.
So these are people who aren't necessarily recording professionally.
Some of them are, some of them aren't. Many of them aren't. And I mean, basically, if one's honest about it, all these things are a matter partially of personal taste, partially of opportunity and availability and just the capacity to do it. I mean, I couldn't put out a Sunny Ade record to save my life because I couldn't afford the advance.
Yeah. Let me play something that the compact disc version of Africa Dances closes out with. And this is something called Love is Love. It's Ethiopian, but it has an incredible Arabic and soul music influence on it. What can you tell us about this? And is this an example of the kind of street music that you're talking about?
Yeah, actually it was recorded in some nightclub by a buddy of mine way, way back. But actually Ethiopian music, there's a group called Mahmoud Ahmed, a record that has just been reissued on CD, which is incredibly electronic. They tend to be heavily into the electronics. And it's kind of difficult. I want to get hold of the Ethiopian street music, but it's just not something I've been able to do. But this particular piece you're going to play is a lovely example of music at a stage before it's all shaken down into a new style, because you have the very Cushitic singing style, the very Ethiopian singing style, and then this rather lumpy soul background.
What do you think this evolved into?
Well, it evolved into the kind of somewhat funk-oriented but very Ethiopian, very electronic music of people like Mahmoud Ahmed and a whole bunch of others that's going on at the moment.
Well, before we hear it, let me thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
And my guest has been John Storm Roberts, and he is the founder of Original Music, which is a company that produces and distributes world music. And he's also the author of the books Black Music of Two Worlds and The Latin Tinge. Most of the music, including the track we're about to hear, is featured on an album he produced back in the early 70s, and the album is called Africa Dances.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist A.C. Green was saved from death by a heart transplant. Coming up, he tells us about his new heart and his new life. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of readings by Jack Kerouac with jazz accompaniment by Steve Allen, Al Cohn, and Zoot Sims. And poet Mark Halliday remembers the tonette. You may remember it as the flutophone, that cheap, shrill, plastic imitation of a recorder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. A federal appeals court panel today set aside Oliver North's Iran-Contra convictions, suggesting that North's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination may have been violated. The judge focused on the congressional testimony North gave under a grant of immunity, ordering a witness-by-witness review of the case. North was convicted on charges stemming from an illegal covert operation to sell arms to Iran and give the proceeds to rebels trying to overthrow Nicaragua's Sandinista government. Mechanical problems have forced NASA to call off tonight's launch attempt of an Atlas I rocket from Cape Canaveral. Trouble with the rocket's fuel system may be the problem. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has more.
The launch attempt was scrubbed just before 4 o'clock Eastern time when technicians began receiving improper readings from the rocket's hydrazine and helium systems. The hydrazine's temperature, which helps steer the Atlas I, was apparently too cold, while the helium system recorded a loss of pressure during the countdown. Technicians will take a look inside the rocket tonight to assess the situation. Another launch attempt could come as early as tomorrow. This was to have been General Dynamics' first attempt at the commercial space launch business. The Atlas I, the newest of the Atlas Centaur series, is set to carry a government radiation satellite into orbit. NASA is acting as a launch manager, assuring that all criteria are met to deliver a safe liftoff. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The House of Representatives will decide whether to reprimand Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank. The House Ethics Committee voted unanimously today to recommend the reprimand against Frank, an acknowledged homosexual accused of improprieties in connection with a relationship with a male prostitute. The ethics panel said Frank violated a House rule on conduct when he used his congressional influence to fix 33 parking tickets incurred by Stephen Gobey, who was using the lawmaker's automobile to run private errands. President Bush called on Montanans to elect another Republican to the U.S. Senate, saying he needs a GOP majority to break the gridlock in Congress. Jackie Yamanaka of member station KEMC reports from Billings, Montana.
President Bush told party loyalists this morning the U.S. needs more Republicans in Congress. He says 29 out of the last 35 years of Democratic control is enough.
And while the Republican Party is using everything we've got to build a strong, competitive America, the Democratic stranglehold on the United States Congress has finally taken its toll.
As a result, the president charges, it's the American people who are paying the price. Mr. Bush spoke at a fundraising breakfast for U.S. Senate candidate Alan Kolstad. The lieutenant governor is challenging incumbent Democrat Max Baucus. For National Public Radio, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials fell 33 points. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer A.C. Green tells us what it's like to get a new heart and a second chance at life. But first, the late Jack Kerouac was one of the most controversial figures in American literature during the 1950s. He wrote poetry and the novels On the Road, The Subterraneans, and The Dharma Bums. Kerouac has been called the father of the Beat Generation. Fans and appreciative critics said he spoke for a generation. His detractors claimed his rambling prose was undisciplined blather. Kerouac's recordings have just been reissued in a new collection. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
The Last Hotel. I can see the blank wall. I can see the silhouette in the window. He's talking. I'm not interested in what he's talking about. I'm only interested in the fact that it's the last hotel.
In San Francisco around 1957, a new fad was born, the jazz and poetry movement. It was destined to become one of the prime cliches of beatnik culture. You know, a guy with shades and a beret reciting lines like, "A black cat walks across a white sheet," while some wigged-out combo blows cool music in the background. It wasn't new in the sense that no one had done anything like it before, but the late 50s was when it became a trend. Before long, it had spread to New York, where Jack Kerouac recited his beat prose at the Village Vanguard, backed by television's resident hipster, Steve Allen. Soon after, Kerouac, like a few other beats, began making records with jazz accompaniment. On the first of them, Poetry for the Beat Generation, Steve Allen makes nice on the ivories.
Hummingbird hums hello, bugs race and swoop. Two ants hurry to catch up with Lonely Joe. The tree above me is like a woman's thigh. Smooth eucalyptus bumps and muscle swells. I would I were a weed a week would leave.
Jack Kerouac made three albums in 1958 and 9. He read solo on one. On another, called Blues and Haikus, he was backed by saxophonists Al Cohn and Zoot Sims.
Beautiful young girls running up the library steps with shorts on. Crossing the football field, coming home from work, the lonely businessman.
All three Kerouac albums, plus outtakes from Blues and Haikus, and part of an appearance on a Steve Allen TV show, are in a new boxed set from Rhino Records called the Jack Kerouac Collection. It's a very nice package, with a 32-page booklet containing lots of photographs and long and short essays by friends like William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg. Kerouac fans have been salivating since this set's release was announced months ago. Here's some of Jack Kerouac's October and the Railroad Earth.
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend. In red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work and offices, in the air you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy. As soon they'll be charging en masse from Market and Sansom buildings on foot and in buses and all well-dressed through working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers. And even the poor grime bemarked Third Street of lost bums, even Negroes, so hopeless and long left east and meanings of responsibility and try. That now all they do is stand there spitting in the broken glass, sometimes 50 in one afternoon against one wall at 3rd and Howard. Here's all these Milbrae and San Carlos, neat necktied producers and commuters of America and steel civilization, rushing by with San Francisco Chronicles and green call bulletins, not even enough time to be disdainful.
Kerouac's claim to fame has also been his curse. As the so-called father of the beats, he was so widely imitated that much of his own stuff seems like a parody. His disdain for necktied office workers was stereotypically beatnik, dumping on Mr. Button-down 9-to-5 middle class. Kerouac was a jazz lover and saw a close relationship between jazz improvising and his own spontaneous prose. He'd type out his stuff at high speed on long rolls of paper, and he'd write variations on finished pieces, generating new ideas from old themes the way jazz musicians do. Still, some jazz folk weren't convinced he knew as much about the music as he thought he did.
Now the tune they were playing was All the Things You Are. They slowed it down and dragged behind it a half-tempo dinosaur proportions, changed the placing of the note in the middle of the harmony to an outer, more precarious position, where also its sense of not belonging was enhanced by the general atonality produced with everyone exteriorizing the tune's harmony. The clonk of the millennial piano like anvils in Petrograd.
As biographer Gerald Nicosia has pointed out, Kerouac's pronunciation of the word Petrograd is a sign he's putting us on. That pseudo-profound gibberish is certainly funny, but you still may not be sure if you're laughing with him or at him. I confess I'm not crazy about Kerouac myself. His writing doesn't grab me, though there is something compelling about his voice, despite his overheated delivery. As a craze, jazz and poetry didn't last too long. But in New York, at least, poets and improvisers still perform together on occasion. And every once in a while, the hybrid still turns up on record. The last good jazz and poetry album I heard was a 1981 session by the late Brian Gyson with the Steve Lacy Sextet.
Kick that habit, man. That habit kick, man. Habit, man, kick that. Man, kick that habit. Kick that man habit. That man habit kick. Habit kick, man. Man habit that kick. Kick
now that's beat. It's got Jack Kerouac's fingerprints all over it.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the Jack Kerouac collection on Rhino Records. This is Fresh Air. A.C. Green was dying of congestive heart failure. His doctors told him his only chance at survival was a new heart. 2 years ago, at the age of 64, he became the first adult patient in a new heart transplant program at the St. Paul Medical Center in Dallas. Green's new memoir, Taking Heart, is the story of his operation and recovery. Green is an essayist and columnist for the Dallas Morning News. He also teaches English at the University of North Texas in Denton. Green says you have to adjust to the beat of a new heart.
A transplanted heart tends to take a little bit longer to warm up and tends to take a little bit longer to settle down. For example, I walk out of the studio here and I may have to take a couple of steps and stop, but then my heart catches up. One of the reasons is that when your old heart is taken out, all the nerves around the heart must be cut surgically. And, of course, at this point, we're still not able to reattach those tiny, tiny nerves. So the heart doesn't have its automatic system. The brain has to tell it, okay, get going. And that takes three or four beats.
The heart is metaphorically always thought of as the emotional center of any person. Have you had to stop looking at the heart in any metaphorical way?
No, it's kind of like the moon. You know, 1969, we put men on the moon. Well, I feel the same way about the heart. It may be a different heart. It may be a new heart, a better heart. But it's still my heart in that metaphorical sense that you mentioned. In other words, if I break my heart, it still can be broken. If I lose my heart, it still can be lost.
Now, you don't know whose heart you got.
I don't know who it is. I do know that it was a man because of my size. I'm about 5'10 and a half and weigh about 180, so I had to have a little larger heart. Hearts have no race, no gender, so if a big woman had been available, I might have gotten her heart. But I just know it was a man, and I understand he was about 31 years old at the time that I got the heart.
You know, in your book, you describe your condition by saying that your heart was dying. And I thought it was very interesting that you'd say your heart was dying instead of saying that you were dying. And I thought, in a way, this was the ultimate mind-body split.
Well, once again, that's the metaphor of the heart. I didn't think about my body dying. And at the time that it was that the heart was probably at its worst point, not at its worst point, but when it was dying most, I was not thinking about me dying. I had detached myself almost from the heart as an organ. I felt as if I had two hearts. One of them was a physical organ, which was really getting bad, but the other one was a kind of overview of my whole self, that secondary definition of heart, which the dictionary uses.
When you were waiting for a heart, how were things prioritized? How was it decided which heart was going to be yours and who would come first on the waiting list?
Well, that's a real problem as far as the general transplant program across the nation is concerned. In my case, it wasn't quite that difficult since I was number one. I was the only one in this new program who was waiting on a heart. Of course, the first consideration in a heart is size and blood type, so that they had to find a heart that was big enough to keep me going, but not so big that it got crowded into that space. In the book, Dr. Ring says, oh, it's just a simple matter of making four cuts. Well, of course, that may be true, four cuts to get the old heart going out and then putting the new one in and getting it going. But at that point, the patient is really embarking on the true transplant life, because after 2 weeks or so, your medication is what's keeping you going. As a matter of fact, I'm still very, very careful. I have twice a day at 9 a.m., 9 p.m., I have to take cyclosporin and take a lot of other medications. I take 22 pills and two liquids, as a matter of fact, per day. But it doesn't bother me in the slightest, since the alternative is not too pleasant to contemplate.
Could you give us a sense of what just the hospitalization and the surgical procedure cost you and what you had to pay after insurance?
Well, my insurance is the kind that you have a certain amount you have to pay initially. Then it goes to, I believe there's $2,000 you have to pay on a 30-70 basis. And then after that, it's complete coverage. So my initial costs were something like about $10,000 or $12,000. Now that was just for the hospitalization and the insurance going in. Also, that includes a lot of flying around. I had to do. I had to fly down to Houston two or three times and back. But I would estimate that after over a period of years, unless things change greatly in the next two or three years, a transplant of any kind, liver, heart, lung, that sort of thing, will run well above $200,000 total. That's hospital, surgeon, medication, all that sort of thing.
Can you share with us some of the things that went through your mind during the 7 months that you waited for a heart?
Well, at first I was very hopeful. I was in the Houston program, Dr. Cooley's program in Houston, and they used to call every week and say, well, we still don't have your heart. And they had their transplant meeting every Monday. And the coordinator would call my wife and say, oh, Ms. Green, we talked about AC today. We just can't get him a heart. We can't get one a suitable heart. And then when I transferred to the New Dallas program, they said, that's fine because maybe you can get one quicker up there. And as a matter of fact, I did, even though I didn't get one immediately even then. But as I got weaker and weaker, I began to realize that to me, and this begins to be very philosophical, I wouldn't demand that the listeners agree with everything I say, but I will say this. Someone waiting for a transplant, any kind of heart, any kind of open heart surgery, any kind of what I call terminal possibility, has to have something to hold on to. You have to believe in something, whether it's God or philosophy or the surgeon or the medical technique. Something you have to hold on to, because you are literally at sea. There gets to be a point when nobody can tell you anything. Your doctor can't even tell you anything, except when we get a heart, if it works, you'll feel better. And so I would say the last 2 months of my waiting, when I was really living in my own separate world, even though my children were trying to be helpful and were very helpful, and my wife was actually dedicating virtually every hour of the day to me, I still had to have something that I could believe in, some reason to stay alive. And I just kind of developed some old down-to-earth philosophy right then that life is good, and the best way to live it is to be as useful as you can be and quit getting. In fact, I've said, I don't fall into the stress pool.
In your book, you write that after the heart surgery, you ended up crying a lot for the first, I don't know, a few days or a few weeks after. Do you know why?
Well, that was a few days. I think that what I was doing, I was kind of asking myself forgiveness for all the wasted things I might have done prior to my heart. I don't want to sound religious or that kind of philosophically inclined, but I felt so good, and at the same time, I wish that things could have been better. I'd had a very happy life. I'd been married at that time. My wife at that time, she and I had been married about 35, 38 years. And I felt, and my children were all around me and they loved me. And I'd had, and I just suddenly realized that I had been kind of mean with myself. And of course, if you're mean with yourself, you tend to be mean with other people. So I just, I was crying, asking myself forgiveness, I guess. But on the other hand, there were tears of joy. I just felt like I had a new life. I'd been given a second chance. And, you know, all of us, from time to time, we talk about a second chance. But to really have a second chance, really get one and recognize it, somebody said, well, how long do you think you're going to live? I don't know. When have I ever known how long I was going to live, or any of us? But at least I'm going to live every minute of it that I can.
Have you signed over any of your organs in case of your death?
I have signed a donor card. In fact, I've joked with the organ bank people in Dallas a lot of times about, well, look, this heart's only 33. If I go the hard way someday, I said, maybe we can give it to a third person. I said, I don't think it's picked up any bad habits with me, because so. Anything else, I'm of an age that mostly what they would use as far as parts is concerned, to put it in rather blunt terms, is it would be skin, tissue, and that sort of thing, possibly something from the eyes, and of course any organ they wanted. At age 66, I think my organs are in pretty good shape.
So if you don't mind my asking, what did the doctors tell you about how long you could expect to live as a heart transplant person?
At one point, 20 years was the record, but I haven't even tried to keep up the last couple of years. I suspect that I might have a pretty good future. I'm not even going to try to put it to the calendar. I will say one thing. Right after I got my heart and I knew it was going to work, I said to the doctor, I said, Ring, I'm 64 now. Can I live to be 100? And he smiled and he says, well, your heart can if you can keep up with it. So I just use that as my rule.
Well, I wish you very good health, and thank you very much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it.
Journalist A.C. Green, his new memoir is called Taking Heart. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing today about the appeal of Oliver North's convictions. One of them was overturned today on the basis of the charge the judge gave to his trial jury. And the judge has also been told to review the possibility that perhaps North's televised testimony before the House Senate Committee on the Iran-Contra affair might have seeped into the prosecution's case, and that would... If that is the case, that would overturn his other convictions. Also, news today of U.S. policy toward El Salvador, a report on Cuba's troubled economy, and we'll also be hearing the music of Marsh Cowboy Brownie Ford.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mark Halliday has a poem about an instrument he was once forced to play. Maybe you were too.
When I was in elementary school, we had to play tiny little flutes that were called tonettes. This is a poem called Tonette. Said yes to Tish and Pat in Mrs. Cockman's fourth grade when they asked if I'd be in a Tonette trio with them to play Down in the Valley and Working on the Railroad in front of the class. Though I must have known it was risky, I said yes because life was so rich and startling and involved with the frightening beauty of the smiles of girls, and to say no seemed a terrible shrinking from the challenge of the glory of life. I said yes to Tish and Pat, and they smiled. but I didn't practice at home. What did I imagine would happen? It seems I felt the beauty of the girls and the courage of my yes would be enough, and my reward for just being there and standing up in front of the whole class amid the deluge of life's stunning overstimulation would be a magical rightness of fingering when I gripped the stubby black tonette and blew. I did not practice at home. There was my arithmetic to do, and studying our geography chapter about llamas in Peru, there was important cowboy action on TV. Surely I must have rehearsed once with Tish and Pat. But if so, I joked my way through it, and I suspect they supported my notion that girls needed to practice tonette, whereas a boy, who got A's in arithmetic and must someday inherit the world's beauty, would just naturally know every note to hit. But I didn't, oh Lord. All I could play was the first 6 or 8 notes of each song, and then confusion flooded me. I was terrifically lost in the gorgeous alien world. Tish and Pat played on, playing carefully to make up for the red-faced boy who stood beside them in front of the vast fourth-grade class and Mrs. Cockman who saw everything, and I kept twisting the mouthpiece of my black tonette all through the 100 hours of Tish and Pat playing every note of each enormous melody. I twisted that mouthpiece and made faces to indicate that if only my instrument were properly aligned, I could play Down in the Valley all day. Nobody believed that bit of theater for a second. Not for a second. When the epic performance ended, I went to my seat, grinning with ears like scarlet beacons. My grin tried to say, "Boys don't need music," but said instead, "I am lost on this planet." Mrs. Cockman let it pass and called on the next performers, and I sat, not quite knowing that I would never forget. Did I learn a lesson? Have I learned it yet? The beauty of Earth cannot merely be met. To stand up beside it, you've got to sweat. Yes is fine, but don't fake your tonette.
Mark Halliday's book of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and commentaries. Our production assistants are Joan Tui and Roseanne Bucci. I'm Terry Gross. Down in the
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor John Glover tells us about playing the heavy. He's currently starring in Gremlins 2 as the developer and TV mogul Daniel Clamp. And TV critic David Bianculli talks to us from L.A., where he's at a conference previewing the upcoming TV season. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.